Thanks, Greg, for that. Well, it's a very well-known but a very pivotal chapter in the evidence of God's great hand in the world. And there it is in verse 6, of course, the theme for tonight, "Thus saith Yahweh, be not afraid of the words which thou hast heard." Thanks, John.
Thank you, Alan. Good evening, class members, young people. Now, we've got to just backtrack a moment tonight because it's been 4 weeks since our last class, so we just got to pick up the threads a little. You may recall that the last historical event that we were looking at, apart from Hezekiah's sickness, was as described in Isaiah 36, where we had Rabshakeh at the head of the Assyrian army outside the walls of Jerusalem demanding the surrender of the city. And Rabshakeh, you may recall, made a particular point of trying to get the people on the wall to recognise that Hezekiah, their king, would be of no help. Just have a look again at Isaiah 36. On four occasions, Rabshakeh appeals to the inhabitants on the wall to not put their trust in Hezekiah. Verse 14 of Isaiah 36. "Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you." Verse 15. "Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in Yahweh." Verse 16. "Hearken not to Hezekiah." Verse 18. "Beware lest Hezekiah persuade you." So you can see there was a degree of cunning and subtlety in the words of Rabshakeh. He was using all the tricks under the sun to try and persuade the people and get them to see that if they thought they were going to win this battle by putting their trust in their king, well then, at the end of the day, he was going to be of no help. And he was desperately trying to swing the people away from their king. Just putting this up on the screen again so we get the picture. You've got Sennacherib, Rabshakeh and his army here, somewhere in the valley, the Kidron Valley. And you may recall that Rabshakeh originally spoke to Shebna and Eliakim, and they appealed to Rabshakeh not to speak in the Jewish language, but to speak in the diplomatic language of the day, which was the recognised language. Rabshakeh ignored their request, and in fact he raised his voice, and you can just picture him raising his voice and waving his fist and shouting to the people who were all here congregating on the walls, leaning over, listening to what was being said. And that was the perfect position that Rabshakeh wanted them in, because as soon as he had the ear of the people, well then of course he let fly with those words from verse 13 to 18. Now, as I've mentioned in previous classes, it is a little difficult to entirely put where the sickness of Hezekiah came into this, but certainly one thing we did establish for sure, and that was that it was certainly before the destruction of the army of Sennacherib. So although, as we have considered, class members, although Isaiah 38, which we considered last class a month ago, takes place after Isaiah 37, as far as the Bible is concerned, yet chronologically it must have occurred beforehand. And the reason for that, as we saw, was in Isaiah 38 verse 6, where Hezekiah, in receiving a reply from his God that his life was to be extended, was given this assurance. Verse 6, "I will deliver thee and this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city." And the sense of that word defend is to throw a covering over the city, to protect it, to hover over it, and to give it all the protection it needed. So that certainly occurred before the destruction. And as I have suggested, it's possible, we can't be for sure, but it's possible that whilst Rabshakeh is delivering these threatening words to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, that may have been the very time when Hezekiah was laid low with his sickness unto death. Well, if that was the case, he of course recovered. So when we come to Isaiah chapter 37, we're now presented with a situation where Hezekiah has recovered from his illness and he receives the threats from Rabshakeh passed on to him by the three men. So we just pick this up in Isaiah 36 and verse 21. Despite Rabshakeh's threats, the people of the city held their peace in verse 21 and answered him not a word. Well, the king's commandment was saying, answer him not. Then came Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, that was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph the recorder to Hezekiah with their clothes rent, and told him the words of Rabshakeh. Now I want you to particularly notice tonight the attitude of mind of Hezekiah, because bearing in mind that in Isaiah 38 he had been given an assurance that the city would not be taken by the Assyrians. And yet despite that assurance, we notice in Isaiah 37 that Hezekiah did not let up. He did not relent in his fervent prayers to his God. In other words, Hezekiah was not a man who, having received the assurance, then relaxed his position and in effect said, well, we're all okay, God has promised us deliverance, therefore it doesn't matter what we do, the city shall be saved. I think Hezekiah, being like so many of the great men of Judah, he very keenly nevertheless felt the precarious position they are in. And that would be quite natural, wouldn't it? Be quite human. It doesn't matter what we are told as to what is going to happen. When we are confronted face to face with the realities of life or death, well then, it's possible, isn't it, that we're just not quite sure as to whether Yahweh will be true to his word or not. Over in Isaiah chapter 8, Isaiah, as we've seen on two or three occasions in the classes, made a prediction that the Assyrians would in fact come right through the land and capture effectively every stronghold bar except one. Isaiah 8 verse 6. For as much as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloah that go softly and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son, now therefore behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria, and all his glory, and he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks, and he shall pass through Judah, he shall overflow and go over. So you get this picture of this raging torrent coming down over the land, and everything is being swept away in its path. Nothing can stand in the path of this flood of Assyria. The waters of the river shall come up strong and many, even the king of Assyria and all his glory, and he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks, and he shall pass through Judah. He shall overflow and go over, and he shall reach even to the neck. Now the neck there represents Jerusalem, I should say. Because you have this picture, just picture if you were trapped in floodwaters, where you're trapped and the height of the river was rising by the minute. And every minute the water is creeping up your body until eventually the water reaches your neck. Now within another minute it's going to reach your nostrils and you're finished. And that's the picture of Isaiah 8, where the water is coming up so fast that it reaches unto the neck, and the next moment will be that the last remaining stronghold has gone under. But it doesn't go under, because Yahweh gave an assurance to Hezekiah that it wouldn't. Now, when I looked at this study on Hezekiah, I tried to sort of give it a more modern application, but then my mind was thinking of the Second World War, and when I look around the hall tonight, it's not particularly modern for most of the people here. Most of the people here were born after the Second World War. But let me just sort of try and paint the picture for you in a more modern 20th century application. When Germany, for example, built up its power under Hitler in the 1930s, first of all, in 1938, Germany took over Austria. And then in 1939, Czechoslovakia. And then in September 39, they overran Poland in what they call a blitzkrieg. It was just a lightning overthrow of the nation, and the whole country of Poland just went under in days. And the world shuddered at the tremendous onslaught that was coming forth from Hitler's army. And then before they knew it, the low countries of Europe were being overrun. There was Holland and Belgium and Luxembourg. And then before they knew it, France had fallen. And there was England as an island power, knowing that if Hitler were to unleash the full force of his army, navy and air force against Great Britain, then they were finished. And it made me think of the time of Hezekiah, because the Assyrians were like that, you see. They were effectively the Nazis of old times, and they just came through the land like a tremendous torrent, and nothing could stand in their way. And I was reading a book when I was preparing the study, and it just hit me, this statement here in Isaiah 8, where it talks about the Assyrians going over and reaching to the neck. Let me just recount a little incident. In 1940, when the French were almost on the verge of going under, and in fact the French government was so weak that they were on the verge of capitulating to the Nazis. They weren't even going to stand up and fight. And Winston Churchill, who was the Prime Minister of Great Britain, got wind of this, and he desperately did not want the French to capitulate, because once the French gave in, well, then you've got all this army of the French no longer fighting the Germans, and Churchill knew that they were next. So when he found out they were on the verge of capitulating, he said to the French generals, he said that it didn't matter what the French would do, that Britain would fight on alone, whatever. In other words, trying to say to the French, we want you there, but don't think that if you give in, we will go under the next day. He said, that won't happen. And when he said that to the French generals went to their Prime Minister, and they rather sneeringly said to the Prime Minister of France, they said, in 3 weeks, England will have her neck wrung like a chicken. In 3 weeks, England will have her neck wrung like a chicken. And it reminded me of this little statement here, that the Assyrians would go over and come even to the neck. Well, as we know, of course, England didn't have her neck wrung like a chicken. She stood up, and eventually Hitler diverted his attention to the east and took on Russia, and that was the salvation of Great Britain. But about a year later, Churchill made one of his overseas visits, and he was invited to speak to the Canadian Parliament. And in December 1941, he stood up in the Parliament of Canada. What's the capital? Ottawa, is it? He stood up there and he was recounting this story of how the French general said to the Prime Minister of France, in 3 weeks, England will have her neck wrung like a chicken. And you can just imagine Churchill, you know, he had this, he probably didn't have the cigar in his mouth at the time, but you can just picture that typical bulldog Churchill face. And there he is standing there in front of the Canadian Parliament and telling them this story. And he paused in typical Churchill style, and in his rather sort of gravelly voice, he said, some chicken, some neck. As if to say, we didn't go under. And I can just picture that scene of him saying that, some chicken, some neck. You know, we're a pretty strong chicken, he said to the Canadians. And Hitler didn't take them over. Now, from a divine standpoint, the same thing could apply, you see. Although Judah could not bask in her strength, because they had no strength, but from a divine standpoint the same thing applied. They weren't a chicken, and they had a very strong neck, and Yahweh had promised that they would not go under. So when we go back to Isaiah 37, we pick up the record. Now, as I said earlier, it was quite easy for Hezekiah to have just sat back and done nothing. But when he received this message from Rabshakeh, we read in verse 1 that when Hezekiah heard it, that he rent his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of Yahweh. So Hezekiah as king went straight into the house, and there he fervently prayed unto his God. What about Eliakim and the others? Well, he did something with them as well. We read in verses 2 to 5, that he sent Eliakim and Shebna and the elders of the priests covered in sackcloth unto Isaiah the prophet with a message. Now bear in mind, he has already been given an assurance that the city won't go under. He goes into the house to pray himself. He sends the two most important men in the town to Isaiah with the chief of the priests, covered in sackcloth, and says in verse 3, "Thus saith Hezekiah, this day is a day of trouble and of rebuke and of blasphemy, for the children are come to the birth and there is not strength to bring forth." As if to say, we have come so far, we have pulled ourselves around with a degree of spirituality, we are ready to serve thee, O Yahweh, but we haven't got the strength to pull through. We're entirely, O God, in your hands. It may be, Yahweh thy God will hear the words of Rabshakeh, whom the king of Assyria his master hath sent to reproach the living God, and will reprove the words which Yahweh thy God hath heard. Wherefore, lift up thy prayer for the remnant that is left. Now see the mind of Hezekiah. You see, he's not just thinking of himself, he's thinking of the nation. They're just a very small remnant that is left, and he desperately wants that remnant to be saved. And so the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah. Now, no doubt, in response to Hezekiah's fervency and the prayer of Isaiah and others, they got a reply very, very quickly. And the reply is given in verses 6 and 7. Isaiah said unto them, "Thus shall ye say unto your master, thus saith Yahweh, be not afraid of the words that thou hast heard," from which our title is taken, as Alan mentioned, "wherewith the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me." Now that is the issue, you see. And in effect, Yahweh is saying to Hezekiah, "I've heard your prayer. I'm taking the load off your shoulders, Hezekiah, because it's not an issue between you and Rabshakeh. It's an issue between Sennacherib and me." You don't come into it, Hezekiah. It's an issue between the Assyrians and me. And you see, once it became an issue between the Assyrians and Yahweh, well, as we know, the Assyrians were finished. Because, you see, it was a challenge against the living God. A challenge. There was no way the Assyrians could succeed. It was not now a matter between Rabshakeh trying to persuade the people not to be deceived by Hezekiah. It was now Yahweh saying to the Assyrians, "You cannot win this battle." And you can imagine the relief in Hezekiah's mind when he heard that, despite the assurances that he had been previously given. Verse 7, "Behold, I will send a blast upon him, and he shall hear a rumour, and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land." And then we read in verse 8, "So Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libna, for he had heard that he was departed from Lachish." Now, if you were in Hezekiah's shoes, wouldn't you be absolutely in a state of exhilaration when you saw that happening? Here was Rabshakeh outside the walls, only a short time before, threatening the city that if they didn't capitulate, they would be made mincemeat. They would be finished. He appeals unto his God, goes into the temple, sends representatives to Isaiah, they fervently pray, Yahweh gives them an assurance that it will not happen. And then, to Hezekiah's amazement, suddenly Rabshakeh just packs up his bags and leaves the city. And you can imagine Hezekiah think, "Whoa, it's all over. That's it. It's the end of the trial. It's finished. All over." And don't we find this true in our life? How many of us from time to time
you know, have difficulties in our life. And maybe particularly pressing problems that come into our life. And we grapple with that. And we fervently pray unto our God. And then, miraculously as it appears, the time of testing passes. And we once again feel on top of things. And we almost seem to think, well, that's it. I'll see it through to the kingdom. And that's how Hezekiah would have thought. But to his amazement, that wasn't the end of it. Because whom Yahweh loves, he chastens. And just because, brethren and sisters, we overcome in a trial, as this was a trial here, doesn't mean to say that's the end of the matter, does it? There are more trials to come, and so we have to be faithful even unto the end. He that endures unto the end shall be saved. It's true, of course, that Rabshakeh had left, but that wasn't the end of it for King Hezekiah or the city. Just like in the days of David or Abraham or Joseph, they had their trials, but they didn't just have one trial. They had continuous trials. And when they overcame one particular difficulty, then to their dismay later on, another raised its head. And so it was with Hezekiah. Yes, Rabshakeh had left, but we find that he had left to receive instructions. We read in verse 8, "So Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libna." Now just here on the screen, whilst Rabshakeh is talking to King Hezekiah, Eliakim I should say, Sennacherib and his army were down here at Lachish. Now, Rabshakeh leaves Jerusalem and goes back to try and find the king of Assyria, finds that he's left Lachish, and he's moved over here to Libna. So the army has shifted. Then we find that whilst the king of Assyria is at Libna, he receives some rather disturbing news in verse 9. He heard say concerning Terhaka, king of Ethiopia, "He has come forth to make war with thee." And when he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah, saying. Now, Sennacherib was in a very precarious position at Libna because he hadn't quite finished off Lachish. He wanted to get the city of Jerusalem to capitulate, and they hadn't. Next to his dismay, he finds that the Ethiopians are coming up in the rear guard, so he's going to be attacked from behind. He's got an undefeated enemy there. He's still got enemies here. And he's worried. So he decides to send a last threatening letter to Hezekiah to say to him, "Now is your last chance. Give in or else." So he sends these messengers back to Hezekiah. Now you see, this is Sennacherib now getting personally involved. Verse 9, "And when he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah, saying, Thus shall ye speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah, saying, Let not thy God, in whom thou trustest, deceive thee, saying, Jerusalem shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria." Now, when I went to the National Gallery in Melbourne and saw that very interesting display on Assyrian artefacts, and they were taken directly out of the British Museum, I came across actual waxed ivory writing boards that were used in the time of Sennacherib, or thereabouts. As you can see there, these are two of a set of 16 writing boards hinged together as a folding set. They were scored on the back and front to receive the wax surface. So the wax surface was put on them, and then they could inscribe on that wax the writing. Now, whether it was in that form that Sennacherib wrote his letter to Hezekiah, or whether it was on parchment, we're not sure. But one thing we do know is that it was a letter. See, it wasn't just a messenger. If you turn over the page in Isaiah 37, and verse 14, we're just jumping a few verses, we read this in verse 14. "And Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it." So you see, it wasn't just a messenger coming from Sennacherib.
and repeating what Sennacherib had said to him, Sennacherib literally wrote out a letter, and possibly on something like this. Wrote it out, signed it, Sennacherib, and sent it off to King Hezekiah. As if to say, well, you may have been able to brush aside my chief, Rabshakeh, but Hezekiah, look at the signature at the bottom of this letter. It is me, Sennacherib. Now what are you going to do? This is no joke, Hezekiah. Now look at the way he puts the pressure on. You see, in Isaiah 36, we read in those verses 14, 15, 16, 17, where Rabshakeh is saying to the people, let not Hezekiah deceive you. Well, Sennacherib's bypassing Hezekiah. He's going straight to the top. He says in verse 10, thus shall ye speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah, saying, let not thy God, in whom thou trustest, deceive thee. He's going right over Hezekiah. He's saying, even your God is not going to save you. Don't let him deceive you. He says, haven't you heard, Hezekiah, in verse 11, of all that the kings of Assyria have done to all lands by destroying them utterly? And do you think you're going to be delivered? Are you the only kingdom that's been able to stand in the way of the lightning advance of my great army? And he takes him back in time. He says, Hezekiah, if you've got time to look up the history books, what do you find that my fathers have done? Not just me, Sennacherib, but my fathers. Verse 12. Have the gods of the nations delivered them which my fathers have destroyed? So it's not just him, you see. He's saying, look, even my fathers have done great and wonderful things, as Gozan and Haran and Reseph and the children of Eden, which were in Telassar. See, he was hoping that by listing greater exploits, more gods, more long-term history of their power, that he would force Hezekiah to realize that they had no hope. He was hoping to terrify Hezekiah. And you can just, in a sense, you see, Sennacherib was standing outside the city walls. He wasn't literally standing there, but in a way he was, wasn't he? By that letter, you can sort of almost picture Sennacherib standing outside the city walls, and he's waving his fist at Hezekiah, and he's threatening him with annihilation. Over in Isaiah chapter 10, we have described by the prophet the advance of the Assyrians. Now, I must admit, when reading this, and I didn't attend this Isaiah class that was in Isaiah 10. And I'm not quite sure when it was. Brian, when was it? 1987, was it? But in Isaiah 10, we either have a literal description of an advance by the Assyrians, or it is a sort of a poetic description. In other words, the prophet is describing the way in which the Assyrians would come down and destroy all opposition. And so we have it there. And those towns mentioned there in Isaiah 10, we're looking now at verse 28. You have this picture of the Assyrians coming down from the north, and one by one, the forts and the strongholds are falling. He has come to Aiath. He has passed to Migron. At Michmash, he hath laid up his carriages. Now, any of those little towns there? Yeah, there's Aiath, there's Michmash, there's Geba, there's Anathoth, there's Nob. And certainly in this atlas that I took this overhead from, the historians consider that the Assyrians did come down that way. So you see, they're coming down through the hill country, and one by one those fortresses are falling. And you get the picture? Each one's falling, and as it's falling, so Sennacherib and his army is getting closer and closer to the city of Jerusalem. So he's come to Aioth, etc., verse 28. They are gone over the passage, they have taken up their lodging at Geba. Ramah is afraid, Gibeah of Saul is fled. Lift up thy voice, O daughter of Galim, cause it to be heard unto Laish, O poor Anathoth, that's there on the overhead. Madmena is removed, the inhabitants of Gebim gather themselves to flee. As yet shall he remain at Nob that day. And so the army comes crashing through the hill country of Judah. Men are being scattered in all directions. Fortresses are being overthrown. Walls are being destroyed. Villages are going up in fire. The army comes at last to Nob, just outside the city walls, as it were. And there, the Assyrian in all his pride and power and pomp, as it were, raises his fist there in verse 32 and shakes his hand against the mount of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. And there in a threatening stance, he shakes his fist at Hezekiah and says, Hezekiah, give in, because you have no hope whatsoever. So isn't the issue clear? The issue, brethren and sisters, is this. It's Hezekiah and Yahweh versus Sennacherib and the Assyrian gods. Yes. Yes, I agree with that. The Egyptians were asked to help, and we looked at that very early in the piece. But in the context of Isaiah 10, was that the context of your comment? Right. Yes, I don't disagree with you. The Egyptians were definitely asked to help by a fifth column group in the city. But I think that by and large Hezekiah won them over. He persuaded them. I'm not talking about the Egyptians. He persuaded the fifth column group in the city that it was a foolish way to go. Thanks, Alec. Now in Isaiah 37, verse 14... you can picture the scene. Hezekiah's now got this letter, and he takes it up into the house of Yahweh. And it's a touching scene, isn't it? You can see him receiving that letter, and he reads it, and he's walking along through the city, up the steps, into the temple. He then spreads that letter out before Yahweh. A very touching scene. And in verses 15 to 20... we have the fervent prayer. Hezekiah prayed unto Yahweh, saying, O Yahweh of hosts, God of Israel, that dwellest between the cherubim. Now, I think the reason why he's saying that is he wants to focus his mind upon the fact that Yahweh was no distant God like the gods of the nations. Here he was, right there in the city, right there in the most holy place. Of course, you can't confine God to one place, but he was represented by the cherubim, and Hezekiah was only meters away from the presence of God, and he felt that he was only meters away from the presence of God, and that's why he's addressing his remarks to the God who was there only meters away. Yahweh, thou that dwellest between the cherubim. He was no distant unknown God. But you know, he was not just a local god either, as the gods of the nations were. Because whilst he may have been between the cherubim, he also says, thou art the God, even thou alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth, and thou hast made heaven and earth. Yes, he could be confined to the most holy place by representation, but he was the creator of everything, and nothing would happen unless Yahweh allowed it. He was God of all the kingdoms of the earth. He was very pointed in his request. I'd like you to notice this. It wasn't a generalized prayer. He specifically asked for something. In verse 17, incline thine ear, O Yahweh, and hear. Open thine eyes, O Yahweh, and see. And hear all the words of Sennacherib. So he names him by name. He personally mentions the foe. He doesn't generalize. He doesn't say, Yahweh, you know the trouble. You understand the difficulties we are facing. He says, Yahweh,
you have seen and heard of what Sennacherib has said. And I'm appealing to you, O Father, to help us in our difficulty, which hath sent to reproach the living God. If you turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 17, I think that Hezekiah, when he uttered these words, had David in mind. When David went forth to fight Goliath, first of all, in 1 Samuel 17 and verse 26, we read there, David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And what did Hezekiah say when he spoke to Yahweh? See and hear all the words of Sennacherib, which hath sent to reproach the living God. Now, whilst we're in 1 Samuel 17, verse 46, why did David want Goliath to be destroyed? Well, there are a number of reasons. Of course, he was the enemy of Israel. But he also wanted it to give glory to Yahweh. Verse 46, this day will Yahweh deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. That was one of the chief reasons why David wanted Goliath to be destroyed. Back to Isaiah 37. What did Hezekiah say? David wanted that all the earth would know that Yahweh was the true God. We read in verse 20 of Isaiah 37. Now therefore, O Yahweh, our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that thou art Yahweh, even thou only. And I think that when we see those cross quotations, it probably helps us to appreciate how well the Old Testament characters knew other Old Testament characters, knew of their writings, knew of their sayings. And David gained great strength from reflecting upon the circumstances of his spiritual father David. You know, on more than one occasion, Hezekiah is directly related to David, isn't he? He's described as being really just like David, his father. And he was. And David was always uppermost in his mind. One of the things I think that comes out of this prayer of Hezekiah too is that he was specific, as I mentioned. And sometimes, and I know I do this in my life, that we are not perhaps specific enough at times. We are general in what we say. If you turn over to Philippians chapter 4, we find that Paul, in writing to the Philippians, encourages us likewise to be specific in what we ask of our God. In Philippians 4 and verse 5, he says, let your moderation be known unto all men, the Lord is at hand. Be careful for nothing, and the RV has, have no anxiety over anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. And the peace of God which passeth all understanding shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. You see, Paul there is encouraging us, isn't he, to be specific. Let your requests be made known unto God. That's what Hezekiah did. He had a problem. The problem was huge. It was Sennacherib. He specifically mentioned Sennacherib. He asked his father to listen and see and hear what Sennacherib had said. And likewise, when we have requests of our God, perhaps we ought to learn from that to be not too general. Of course, it's not always possible to be specific in everything, because there may be many things you wish to mention to your father, but there may be particular things that specifically you want an answer to, and we should be specific. So going back to Isaiah 37, and Isaiah portrays this beautiful scene of the king of Judah laying these cause before his God. He makes mention of the fact that Yahweh can see, he can hear. And there was a point in that, you see, because the psalmist in, I think it's in one of the psalms, Psalm 115, mentions how that the idols of the nations are nothing. They're just wood and stone. They can't see, they can't hear, they can't speak. And David, in writing that psalm, was sort of impressing his readers with the reality of God. And Hezekiah had that sense of reality. He could almost picture his God meters away in the most holy place. Well, such prayers, as we know, do not go unheeded. And in verses 21, I should say, onwards, we have the reply. Then Isaiah, in verse 21, the son of Amos sent unto Hezekiah, saying, now look at the specific reply that comes from Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh, God of Israel, whereas thou hast prayed to me specifically against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, I'm giving you a reply, Hezekiah. This is the word which Yahweh hath spoken. Thus saith Yahweh, God of Israel. This is the word which Yahweh hath spoken concerning him, the virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee, and laughed thee to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem hath shaken her head at thee. Now actually, from verses 22 onwards through to verse 29, it's actually a direct reply to Sennacherib. And that's interesting, you see, because Sennacherib, when he sat down to write his letter, and he probably didn't do it personally, but he may have signed it personally, of course, but when he got his servant to write out that letter, he was thinking that he was writing a letter to Hezekiah. Now write this letter to Hezekiah and put in it that he's a fool if he doesn't capitulate, because everyone else has gone under. No nation has been able to withstand me. And Sennacherib's there down in Libna thinking, these people, these Jews, they think they can stand up against me. Now little did Sennacherib know that it wasn't Hezekiah that was going to reply to the letter at all. You see, that's the point of Isaiah 37. Hezekiah didn't reply to the letter. Sennacherib got a reply, but it was a reply directly from God. You see, verse 22. This is the word which Yahweh hath spoken concerning him. And when you stood there on the hill of Nob, Sennacherib, and waved your fist at Jerusalem, and threatened them with annihilation if they didn't surrender, who did you think you were? You were reproaching the living God. And my people, in verse 22, are just like a poor, innocent little girl. The virgin, defenseless, can do nothing. But that tender little girl is going to bring you to your knees. You see, you've got the picture of the great warrior on the hill of Nob threatening them with annihilation, and the reply comes from a little virgin. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee and laughed thee to scorn. That's Psalm 2, isn't it? Laughed thee to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem hath shaken her head at thee. You might have been shaking your fist, but my little girl is shaking her head at you. And Sennacherib, when you wrote your letter, who do you think you were challenging? Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? And against whom hast thou exalted thy voice and lifted up thine eyes on high? Even against the Holy One of Israel. It wasn't Hezekiah, Sennacherib, that you were threatening. It was my little girl. Even against the Holy One of Israel. And you thought that you were doing all this under your own power. You've got it all wrong, says Yahweh. Don't you realise that everything that has happened has been because I've allowed it? Verse 24, by thy servants hast thou reproached the Lord, And you have said, by the multitude of my chariots am I come up to the height of the mountains. I have taken the choicest of the land. Yes, I've marched through Lebanon. I've taken all the choice land of Carmel. I've cut down the forests. I've dried up the wells. Verse 25, I've digged and drunk water. With the sole of my feet have I dried up all the rivers of the besieged places. And you thought you were doing this all yourself. And then we have the scorning reply from Yahweh in verse 26. Hast thou not heard long ago how I have done it, and of ancient times that I have formed it? Do you think you were doing this through your own power, Sennacherib? Not at all. God rules in the kingdoms of men. Now have I brought it to pass that thou shouldest be to lay waste. I've allowed you to do this, Sennacherib. I've allowed you to take cities and villages and nations and people. Therefore their inhabitants were of small power. In effect, Yahweh had softened them up. He had allowed the Assyrians to overrun them. It went to his head. He was full of pride. They were dismayed and confounded. They were as the grass of the field and as the green herb, as the grass on the housetops, and as corn blasted before it be grown up. But I know thy abode and thy going out and thy coming in and thy rage against me. And because thy rage against me and thy tumult has come up into mine ears, therefore will I put my hook in thy nose and my bridle in thy lips, and I will turn thee back by the way which thou camest. So there's the answer to Sennacherib. A direct reply from Yahweh in verses 21 through to verse 29. He was going to be dragged back the way that he came and carted all the way back to his capital. And we find at the end of this chapter, there he received his just deserts. Well, now in verse 30 onwards, we have Yahweh speaking to Hezekiah. You see, he's dispensed with the Assyrians. They haven't been destroyed as yet, have they? They're still there. The army's still outside the walls. But Yahweh has said it, and it will happen. They're finished. They were going to be destroyed later, but they're finished. So now Yahweh can direct his attention to Hezekiah and give him words of encouragement. Verse 30. This shall be a sign unto thee, Hezekiah. You shall eat this year such as groweth of itself, and the second year that which springeth of the same. Because, you see, the Assyrians had ravaged the country, and they were poor, they had nothing. So Yahweh says, this year you will just eat of whatever grows in the field, and the same the second year. But in the third year, you'll be able to go out and sow and reap and plant vineyards and eat the fruit thereof. And you know how Hezekiah at the beginning of this chapter prayed for the remnant? Just look at that again in verse 4, where we read, wherefore lift up thy prayer for the remnant that is left. Well, here's the answer. Verse 31. And the remnant that is escaped of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go forth the remnant, and they that escape out of Mount Zion, the zeal of Yahweh of hosts, shall do this. Now, what a tremendous encouragement was given to this king. He appealed for help to the remnant, and he was given an answer. He appealed that something be done about Sennacherib. He's given an answer. He is assured that it will happen. And now, I think, for the first time, Hezekiah is able to appreciate the reality that all this is going to happen. And he feels these words coming forth from Yahweh like a flood. I mean, the Assyrian may have come down like a flood, but now the words of Yahweh are coming out like a flood. One after the other, words that speak of the finality of his purpose. Verse 33. Therefore thus saith Yahweh concerning the king of Assyria. He shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow there. Now, brethren and sisters, how many men were outside the city of Jerusalem? 185,000. Don't you think one of them would have had a bit of a shot? 185,000 bows just ready. Thus saith Yahweh concerning the king of Assyria. He shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with shields, nor cast a bank against it. In other words, those siege banks that they used to build up, great earth mounds, from which they, from the height, they could then shoot arrows over the walls of the city and kill the defenders. He said there will be no siege banks, no arrows, nothing. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and shall not come into this city, saith Yahweh. Now notice that little phrase there, for I will defend this city to save it for mine own sake and for my servant David's sake. I'd like you to go back to Isaiah chapter 31. This is going back into Brian's territory of old. Isaiah 31. And this is one of the interesting things about the prophecy of Isaiah. The chronological order of the chapters is all over the place, but that in itself makes it interesting, because you see you're continually being reminded of this very central theme in the early books of Isaiah. And the central theme is basically the Assyrians and the kingdom of God, and it's continually coming up. So here we are, six chapters back in Isaiah 31. And we find there that it's talking about defending the city. Verse 5. As birds flying. Now in the Revised Standard Version it reads like this: as little mother birds hovering. So you've got the picture of a mother bird hovering over its young, protecting it. And quite often we've seen that, haven't we, in the chook pen, where the mother hen gathers the little chickens under its wings. And ducks do the same, don't they, Brian? As little mother birds hovering, I got it right then, so will Yahweh of hosts defend Jerusalem. Now that word defend, in the Hebrew it has the sense of throw a covering. See the sense? As little mother birds hovering, so Yahweh will throw a covering over Jerusalem. Just like the hen is covering Jerusalem and defending it, or covering it, also he will deliver it. And passing over, and that word passing over is the same word as the Passover from Exodus, passing over, he will preserve it. And so we read in verse 8 of a prophecy by the prophet, then shall the Assyrian fall with the sword, not of a mighty man, so he wouldn't be human defeat, and the sword, not of a mean man, shall devour him. But he shall flee from the sword, and his young men shall be discomfited. And he shall pass over to his stronghold for fear, and his princes shall be afraid of the ensign, saith Yahweh, whose fire is in Zion, and his furnace is in Jerusalem. Well, now, when we go over to Isaiah 37, it's the same language, you see. In fact, Isaiah said this to King Hezekiah in verse 6 of Isaiah 38. When he was sick unto death and he recovered, and the assurance that he was given in Isaiah 38 verse 6 was this: I will deliver thee and this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will throw a covering over this city. So he was promised that, you see. And Isaiah promised it in chapter 31. Well, now here it is in verse 35. Once again, he's promised this: I will throw a covering over this city and save it for mine own sake and my servant David's sake. And then we read those well-known words in verse 36, which of course was always a bit of a point of amusement, wasn't it, when we were younger, perhaps even older. How that the angel of Yahweh went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. It always used to amuse me how that these dead corpses would get up and look at themselves and then lie down again. But I think the they is referring to the first they that arose early in the morning is referring to the inhabitants of the city, don't you think? But just a question, why does it say that they're all dead corpses? I mean, if you're dead, that's enough, isn't it? You don't need to throw in the corpse as well. I mean, a corpse generally is dead. I've never seen a live corpse. Right. So it's a very definitive, certain death. They were stiff. See, notice there, it doesn't say they were dying. There was no one dying. There was no one sort of, how would you put it? I mean, although they were freshly dead, but I think the reason why it's got dead corpses is that it was absolutely definite. No one could sort of, as it were, grab hold of someone's arm. Oh, he's still got a bit of warmth in him. Yeah, you know, we might be able to bring this one around. No, they were finished. All dead corpses. Class here tonight? Oh, no reply. Now, have you all heard of this wonderful poem by Lord Byron? Let me just read this to you. It's very, very dramatic. Now, picture the Assyrian. Better put this up on the screen. Picture the Assyrian, either literally or poetically, charging through the hill country of Judah. One by one, the fortresses are falling. He gets to the city of Nob and raises his fist, threatens Jerusalem with annihilation. Then the city is surrounded by the army. And Lord Byron, a great poet of note, so I understand, composed this poem. The Assyrian came down like the wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold. And the sheen of their spears were like stars on the sea when the blue waves roll nightly on deep Galilee. Like the leaves of the forest when summer is green, that host with their banners at sunset were seen. Like leaves of the forest when autumn hath blown, that host on the morrow lay withered and strown. For the angel of death spread his wings on the blast and breathed on the face of the foe as he passed, and the eyes of the sleepers waxed deadly and chill, and their hearts but once heaved and forever grew still. And there lay the steed with his nostrils all wide, and through it there rolled not the breath of his pride. And the foam of the gasping lay white on the turf, and cold as the spray of the rock-beating surf. And there lay the rider, distorted and pale, with the dew on his brow and the rust on his mail. The tents were all silent, the banners alone, the lances unlifted, the trumpet unblown. And the widows of Asher are loud in their wail, and the idols are broke in the temple of Baal, and the might of the Gentile, unsmote by the sword, hath melted like snow in the glance of the Lord. And I reckon that's a very dramatic poem which captures 185,000 brought to nothing by the stroke of Yahweh. And just concluding now in Isaiah 37, let me just highlight for you how wonderful was the deliverance for the city. We read in verse 37, "So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. And it came to pass, as he was worshipping in the house of Nisroch his god, that Adrammelech and Sheritzah his son smote him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Armenia, and Esarhaddon his son reigned in his stead." Now, what have we got in this chapter? We have one king, Hezekiah, who, when he received a letter, went up into the most went up into the holy place, and there he prayed to his God. And was his prayer answered? Most certainly was. So that's one king. Just an insignificant king of a small little outpost on the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. Just nothing. Then you've got another king. Great King Sennacherib. You remember on the first night I showed you how that he was probably one of the most proudest men that ever lived. So here's another king. Well, he's a worshipper too. So when he gets back to Nineveh, he worships in verse 38. Just like Hezekiah worshipped. And he sought for fame and glory from his God. And what did he get? A dagger in the back. And what a contrast. And I think it's deliberate the way Isaiah's presented that. You've got one king praying to his God and is delivered. You've got another great king who goes into his temple and he prays. And all he gets is a stab in the back. What a tremendous end to this crisis that faced the nation. And that really is the end of the dramatic times that confronted the nation with the Assyrians. You know, when you have a look at the prophecy of Isaiah, as we have over quite a few years, and as I mentioned in my first study, you'd be surprised how many chapters are devoted to the Assyrians. We go right back to Isaiah 7, 8, 9, 10, 22, 30, 31, all those chapters dealing with the Assyrians. Here we are now 27 chapters later, or 30 chapters after chapter 7, and we're still dealing with the Assyrian. But now at last, brothers and sisters, he's finished. And that's the end of him. And he passes off the scene. And God willing, next fortnight, we'll consider the end of Hezekiah's life, which to some extent was a bit of a letdown, but nevertheless, I think it is quite a warning for us all. So we didn't leave much time for questions tonight because of the nature of the study. We had to get through this chapter in a flow-on style, but there's plenty of time there for discussion.